Saturday night, last night, was beyond surreal. For almost 2 weeks, Israel has been on the highest alert, waiting for a much-anticipated Iranian response to Israel's recent attack on the IRGC in Damascus. Would Iran hit Israeli embassies abroad? Jewish targets? Attack Israel directly? Yes, I think it's fair to say that the people of Israel have been very, very anxious. But as they do, they carried on. Because that's what you do. You either go fetal or put one foot in front of the other. At around 9 p.m. last night, Saturday night, a directive from the Home Front Command was issued. All color-coded and a little too complicated. People are strained. So they generally ignored the gradations of color-coded cautions and direction. Everyone just went into survival mode, made sure they had emergency provisions, like water and food. Stores were busy. Streets were busy with people getting home. And we waited. We thought, we may be alive tomorrow. We may wake up in some kind of post-apocalypse horror movie. Or anything in between. I watched Israeli TV last night, and all it did was make me more anxious. So at around 1 a.m., I took a pill and slept like a baby until 9:30 this morning. I had no idea as to what had transpired. There were no alarms in Tel Aviv, and I live in central Tel Aviv. If you are listening, please consider supporting us with a paid subscription at stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. We're here. We're not going anywhere. We don't helicopter in and out. We do not report and hold forth from a distance. We are here. And we have great contacts and information in real time. And we really need your support to do what we do. So please consider buying a cup of coffee each month for me and my awesome and dedicated team. Please, if not now, when? Now, how's that for a guilt trip? Oh, and keep in mind, the economic impact of this ongoing crisis has been deep and wide, and it's nowhere near over. Now, to the podcast. The amazing Yaakov Katz is here for his usual Sunday spot, always on deck for the State of Tel Aviv. And yes, even today, Yaakov was smiling. He can't help himself. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the unscathed and very relieved State of Tel Aviv. Stay with us. It's incredible, but I'm able to say good morning, Yaakov.
Good morning, Vivian. After last night's...
Oh my God.
I think we all need a vacation.
We needed one before. Pretty crazy. Yeah. So last night I was, like everybody else, feeling highly anxious with my bags packed for I don't know what purpose and watching Channel 12, which is TV channel here, and getting more and more anxious. At around 1 a.m., I took a pill and I slept for 9 hours, which is crazy. You didn't.
I did not. I actually had a bag packed for a different reason. I packed my bag towards the end of Shabbat. I was supposed to fly to the U.S. to Washington for a conference tomorrow on Monday. So I was supposed to fly last night, get there midday Sunday. And then right after Shabbat comes the announcement that everybody needs to basically hunker down. I made a couple of phone calls and realized this is more than just a precaution. Something is rolling and it's happening. And I had a cab downstairs at 9 p.m. going to take me to the airport. And basically, I sat for 5 minutes and thought to myself, what do I do? And I decided not to fly. More, not that I'm needed in Israel, but just for my family. You know, I have 4 kids at home, and I saw what was going through their minds. Because as you know, and you watch, this was almost like reality TV. You know, we're saying, yes, the drone attack is on its way. They're coming. They're going to get here at 2 a.m.
It's insane.
It's insane.
So I was at Hostage Square last night for the rally, and it was quite well attended, not as many people as usual, but it was very intense, and it was the home front directive came through while I was there. I was one of the first to leave. You could see people like wanting to go all of a sudden, but kind of embarrassed to go, right? How do we leave this place when they're still held hostage? And it turned into a flood. Like all the people started to leave. All the stores were jammed up with everyone buying the bare essentials, which I'd already stocked up on. And then I got home and it was surreal. Watching on TV, these drones coming over, reading what we're reading. I was just saying to someone, the shots on Channel 12 of the airport kind of closing down step by step, but nobody really able to answer any questions, right? Because nobody knew what was really going on. So it was like being able to see the airport on Yom Kippur when airspace closes over Israel, but there's no TV. It was so creepy. And they're going to arrive at 2 a.m. They're going to arrive at 5 a.m. What's going on? So I want to hear from you. What the hell went on? And one more thing, because you're just going to go, okay? I'm going to interrupt very little. I'm no military historian, and I don't know about war strategies and air forces like you do, but strikes me that the multinational Air Force combined exercise / real life drill last night was unprecedented. The countries participated, and how incredibly effective it was. And God bless America. Thank you, America.
I think we are facing a very complicated and difficult dilemma. Because on the one hand, you're right. If you look at it from a defensive position, this was a huge success. There were over 300 drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles fired at Israel. And except for the one child who was unfortunately seriously wounded in southern Israel from shrapnel, probably from an interception, there's no one wounded. There's no real damage within Israel. They're talking about how 99% of all of this Iranian attack was intercepted by the Jordanians, by the Americans, by the British, and of course, by Israeli missile defense systems and the Israeli Air Force.
So were the French and UK and Saudis were also involved, no?
Apparently, yeah. The Saudis, they're not, there was some involvement. They're not saying that publicly, but it seems like there was. This was an international coalition that stopped an Iranian attack. Now, you could say to yourself, this is a victory, right? This is a win. We prevented Iran from being able to carry out its assault against Israel. On the other hand, and this is what has me very concerned, that is October 6th thinking. That is saying, yeah, we have missile defense. They have weapons they can shoot at us. We can shoot them down. So we're okay. We don't have to deal with the problem. That's the way we thought up until 6:29 a.m. on October 7th, when they crossed into our border from Gaza and raped and murdered and pillaged and abducted and burned. And we now know after October 7th, that containment policy doesn't work. Now, it doesn't work for Gaza. Will it work for Iran? I doubt it, because they're watching us and they're saying to themselves, hold on, if we were able to do this and there's no response and there's no retaliatory attack, we could do this again. And look at, Vivian, as much as it was a success, I'm just going to look at my four children as an example and my little home here, where my neighbor also had to carry down two babies into the bomb shelter at 2 a.m., whenever it was. My kids.
Hang on. You guys had sirens last night?
Yeah, we had sirens in Jerusalem at 2 a.m.
Did not have a single siren.
No, Tel Aviv didn't. But we had, because remember, they crossed in over, some of them came in from Jordan, and they flew over Jerusalem. So we started to hear booms at about 2. Those were interceptions that were already taking place over near the Dead Sea, West Bank, Jordan Valley. And then like a minute later, the siren went off here. But I forget about even the siren. I was watching my kids in the run-up to this whole thing. They were glued to their phones. And one of my children came to me, actually two of them, and said, Dad, are we going to die tonight?
Oy.
And I'm sure I was not alone. There were people all over this country, millions of Israelis who thought this might be our demise. Millions. And this is not normal. We cannot live like this. And it should not be expected of us to live like this. Now, what's happening, though, and this is why I'm a little upset, is that I see where the world is directing and steering us, right? You read, you see the call that Biden had with Netanyahu. You read the readout from the call. He's talking to the G7 and he's convening the Security Council. And every country is talking about how they stand with Israel. And we stand with Israel and as it's attacked and its right to self-defense, blah, blah, blah. They don't want us doing anything. They want us to sit in the corner and play again the weak and attacked Jew. And I think that those days need to come to an end. And I'm not, again, some people are going to say, what are you, a warmonger? You just want war? No, I want to change the reality because this is not normal. We should not have to live like this.
Let me just kind of devil's advocate you for a moment, because I have to admit, confess that when Israel struck Damascus in what seems to have been a consular building and killed a whole bunch of IRGC officials, including a top general, my question to myself, was that really smart and necessary at this moment? Yes, I understand that the general who was the real target was very involved in the October 7th preparation and training, but I sit here as just a normal person and look at it and think, we really have enough on our plate right now. We don't need to poke the bear. We can defer that. And then we have all this craziness as it is in this country, and we have the hostage thing, which is really gutting the psychological well-being of this country in a way that it's difficult to explain. And then we have last night. And I'm thinking, among all the things that you talk about and how much can we withstand, and I don't have young children to placate, my kids are older, we can only withstand so much, and is now the time. We have a lot on our plate, Jakob, so we can start to plan and strategize and behave differently going forward. But I worry about the government in charge now and what they might do, because I have no confidence in their judgment.
I am skeptical of our leadership as well. Trust me. I'm skeptical, and I know that we have a lot on our plates. And we just saw last night also the Mossad statement that Hamas has returned with a negative answer to the new proposal for a prisoner swap or a hostage swap that's on the table. The reality, though, is such that, and this is what makes this dilemma tough, and I understand the complexity here. On the one hand, you need to boost your deterrence, and the Iranians are going to learn a lesson. If we don't do anything now, they will learn a lesson that they can do this again in the future. And that's going to be bad because it will happen again, right? When you look, for example, since October 7th, there have been about 200 attacks against U.S. military positions and bases throughout Iraq, Syria, and Jordan. America, in all of its attacks, responded only by they were all attacks by Iranian proxies, and it responded attacking Iranian proxies. Iran itself has immunity, and they believe they have immunity. And last night, again, if there's no response, we'll teach them that they have immunity. So it's only going to be a matter of time until the next attack against Israel or against anyone else. Do we want to live like that, or do we want to try to change that? And I think, on the other hand, though, I totally understand. We've got a lot on our plate. We got an unsettled war in Gaza. We have 133 hostages that are still being held in Gaza. We have a tenuous situation and relationship right now with the United States. And I'll add more than that. I'm sure that in that phone call between Biden and Bibi, in the middle of the night, Biden said to Bibi, listen, don't respond. There's a bigger story. You know, there's a bigger picture. I got the Saudis are helping. The Jordanians are helping. Everybody's helping. You have a new region. Seize that. That's your win. Take that as your victory lap. And who knows where that leads. So I can imagine what's going through. This is a tough call for Netanyahu. And it's not going to be an easy one. It wouldn't be easy for Benny Gantz or for Naftali Bennett or Yair Lapid or for Netanyahu.
Tough call, indeed. I hear everything you're saying. We have to change the paradigm. We have to send a message to Iran. But maybe after, maybe in a year, maybe in two, take the time to manage what we've already got going on and take the time to develop positive relationships with whoever's in power in America and whoever's in power here. But the way things are now, it strikes me, is not the time to make massive shifts in, you know, paradigm thinking and acting. And I'm going to throw another spanner in the wrench.
Yeah.
Right? Did I get that right? War cabinet and the heads of the Air Force here and the Army. If Bibi Netanyahu comes up with something that is a bit Dr. Strangelove, which is not, in my view, impossible, this is the time when they could say no. This is the time when they could say no. We're not doing this. This is Iran. This is not Hamas. We simply cannot obey your orders. Go crazy. Play with that scenario.
No, listen, there's no question that Netanyahu specifically has long been the, you know, the canary in the coal mine, let's call it to some extent, about Iran, and has been the one who's been warning the world has to take down Iran. And there were repeated attempts over the years of him, apparently, that he claims that he tried to get the army, you know, to attack, and the army stood up against him. I don't believe those stories, because at the end, as you're the prime minister, if you want to do something, you have to push it through. He has yet to take that action against Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, is this maybe now the legitimacy that Israel has waited for to be able to launch that offensive against Iran? Maybe. I'm a little skeptical, but I do think, because the spectrum of what Israel could potentially do is quite wide, right? Won't even have our fingerprints. We could take out some Iranian general again. We could attack just the base from which those drones and missiles took off from. Or we could go all out and attack all of Iran, right? Which we haven't done yet, so unlikely that's what we're going to do. I do, though, want to go back, though, to what you said before about why did we attack this Iranian general in Damascus in that so-called consular building. And I think that there's two important points to make. One is, you know, Iran, through its proxies, has been attacking Israel since October 8th, right? Thousands of missiles from Hezbollah, dozens if not hundreds of missiles and drones from the Houthis, and of course Hamas, which is another proxy. This is the first direct attack by the Iranians, but we've been under attack from Iran now for 6 months. So this person in this General Zahedi was a legitimate target. Now, still with that said, the question is, like you pointed out, Vivian, why now, right? Well, why escalate things if you don't have to?
And why take him out in what we think was a diplomatic / consular building, even if we think Iran is a rogue state? Why not do it the way it's usually done, you know, when he's in a moving car or a truck?
I think that the answer to that question is, A, Israel disputes whether this was a consular building, but put that aside for a moment. There was an operational opportunity, and they've been after this guy, apparently, I've heard, for a while, and they got him, and he was available, and they were able to take him out. So that answers that question. The issue, though, of why now, from my understanding, and I could be wrong, but from what I've heard, when the strike against Zahedi was brought to the cabinet, the assessment by the intelligence, you know, military intelligence, Mossad and others, was that the Iranian response would not be beyond the normal of what we've gotten used to, right? They were wrong. And this is the second time in the last 6 months that they've made strategic mistakes in their intelligence assessments. And that raises a whole other slew of questions that I think we need to deal with, because I wonder if the cabinet had known that this is what would have happened, would they have approved that strike against Zahedi? Or would they have said, actually, like you said, why now? Right. So then there's the conspiracy theories, right? If you want to go that route, which is that Israel wants this, they wanted the escalation, they want to go to a war with Iran, that I find hard to believe.
I find it all hard to believe. And I find it distressing in the extreme that such a colossally unimaginable error in judgment from our storied intelligence services was made for the second time. And what we in 6 months, and what we don't know is how many other times inside those 6 months. I thought today we might be talking about the hostages and the explosive UVDA, Israel 60 Minutes program that was on Thursday night, but we're not going to have time to do that today. So this is my point about, you know, just stand down, calm down, stick to your knitting, get the jobs done that you have on your plate, and let's get down to this, you know, huge shift / response, different way of thinking. When we have leadership in place everywhere, in whom not just the people of Israel have confidence, but the nations that support us, and you can hate Biden and you can rant and rave about him and how horrible he's been. But the fact is, this country would not be standing today had America not done what it did last night.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special. A 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. Stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
I think we owe Biden and the U.S. military a huge
huge things.
Huge. And gratitude. But I also think that at the end of the day, Israel has to do what is in its interest. And it has to protect and safeguard the security of this country. And we will always be looking at these threats differently than Americans. With all due respect to Biden, 333 drones and missiles were not fired into Washington, D.C. and New York last night. They were fired and they flew over Jerusalem and Beersheba and Dimona and many other parts of this country. This is not something, and again, I know that
we have to do things, take action that we can then deal with so that's commensurate with what our defensive capability is. We would have
But Vivian.
He had no ability to intercept those drones on our own last night.
I don't know if we would have intercepted all of them, but we could have intercepted most of them. 100%. Come on. Between Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow, and our Air Force, we could have intercepted. And I think we'll find out what the exact numbers are because they haven't come out exactly who intercepted what. But I think that Israel would have been able to intercept many of them. Now, the way to look at this threat, it's a philosophical question. Just because if a tree falls in a forest and no one heard it, did it really fall? So the same thing here. If missiles were launched at you, but they didn't land because you intercepted them, were they really launched? Yes, they were launched with the intention to kill you. So you managed to intercept them, but you should maybe look at them as if they all killed people. And you know, and I know that if 333 drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles landed in Israel and killed people and destroyed infrastructure, we would be in an all-out war right now.
And we also remember last night, I'm sure you were concerned and your kids were, and so was I, that Hezbollah may jump in to the front.
Yes, of course.
And they've got how many 150,000 missiles aimed and targeted from underground launchers in South Lebanon aimed at Israel, correct? They didn't fire. If they did fire, they didn't fire many. But they could do that in a second, and they didn't. So on top of whatever destruction Iran could cause, Hezbollah could jump in as well. And then the Houthis, but I'm going to consider them more like Hamas. But how much can Israel withstand? And this is my concern, is before we go in and counterattack, we just need to get our house in order a bit. That's what I think. And I think that the strain on the population, with whom there's been inadequate and terrible communication, in my view, Homefront Command left us dangling until 9 o'clock last night.
The government left us dangling. Also, this whole thing that, you know, you go through the whole Shabbat. Everything is, you know, relatively quiet. Then suddenly Shabbat ends and the IDF chief spokesman, Daniel Hagari, goes on TV and says, hey, guys, listen, all kindergartens, all schools are closed. Can't have gatherings. Can't this, can't that. Ben Gurion Airport, you suddenly find out, is going to be closing from 12:30 to 7:30. My flight was actually taking off at 12, so I could have made it if I wanted to. It actually did take off.
Oh, did it?
But,
okay.
Yeah. But why is Hagari doing this? Like, where's our leadership? Where is the reassurance and the confidence that we need? Listen, we're a nation in trauma. And I think people don't understand that around the world. For them, they've moved on from October 7th. We haven't. And the reason we haven't, it's still an open wound, is because 133 people are still being held in some dark hole somewhere in the Gaza Strip. And we don't know what their fate is. And we don't know how many are alive and how many are dead and if they'll ever come home. So we live with that every single day. And now we have Iran sending missiles and drones and cruise missiles at us. What is it? Is there a prize at the UN for being the most attacked country in the world? I don't understand. And you know what? Just because now the whole world, you know, I was on CNN just before this morning. The anchor was reading off, you know, the Dutch and the EU and the Americans and the Canadians and this country and that country, everybody giving us their support, everybody. You and I both know, you know this better than I do, Vivian, that the moment we do something in response, all that support, it just goes out the window within a second, because we're only good when we're under attack.
We're only good when we're dead or we. Yes.
Yes.
Totally.
Okay.
Having said that, you just kind of made it's really interesting, because this is a bit of a Venus and Mars moment, and I'm in it some twisted way enjoying it. But
you kind of made the point when you just said that, you know, we had the IDF chief spokesperson, Daniel Hagari. Great guy, Daniel. You're fantastic. You're doing a great job. But Daniel Hagari coming out at this insane moment when hundreds of drones and missiles are headed towards us. We know basically nothing. We're given no information. By the way, public shelters in Tel Aviv were closed. I live in an old building without a shelter, without a anything. And we have the IDF spokesperson coming out to talk to us. As you said, where are our leaders? And that's exactly what I was wondering last night. Nothing. Benjamin Netanyahu loves the camera. He loves to come out with that great baritone and talk to us and tell us how everything's just fine. He's got everything under control. We, as a nation, psychologically, may be beyond the breaking point. So all of these military intelligence geniuses, in whom I have very little confidence at the moment, and I don't think I'm alone in that, are clearly not paying attention to some really basic stuff. You were going to leave last night and go to America to speak at a conference, and you didn't because you took stock of how this was impacting your family, right?
Yeah.
They're not looking at their families. When I say their families, I don't mean their nucleus. They're not looking
for sure.
People.
By
and
the way,
it's not something you just overlook and count missiles. And
you and I have spoken about this before. I think you made this point a few weeks ago of how, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, you just said this now, is that, you know, the great orator of Israel, right? The great speaker on behalf of Israel. How come we haven't seen him go to the UN Security Council, go give a speech in the Bundestag, go somewhere and hold up a picture of, you know, Carmel Gat or one of the other hostages who's still being held, Hirsch Goldberg Poland, one of the hostages who's being held in Gaza? How come he's not using his skills for that? And I think that the answer is about the hostages specifically. He doesn't want to be associated as much as he can move himself away from the failure and the fact that these hostages are still being held in Gaza. And I think that also last night, what we saw is a continuation of that type of thinking. And Netanyahu did put out a recorded message in the end, but I think that it's all about this type of idea that if I embrace it and I own it, then it sticks to me. And I don't want any of this stuff to stick to me, especially when I don't know how it's going to play out, right? So it's almost an evasion to some extent of responsibility. And I think that the Israeli people and the mass hysteria that's here and the anxiety and the fear, again, it's not normal that we have now millions of people who are staying home today. I was out on the street before here in Jerusalem, empty, eerie. People are, you know, are still not going out. Even, no, it's over. It's not over. What's happening? We need leadership that reassures us, that gives us confidence and a sense of security, because we don't, we're scared. We're scared and we're scarred still from October 7th.
And, you know, maybe this is like maternal Viv coming out, but if I kind of take that and overlay it onto a national, in a national context, we need to take care of our home now. We need to take care of our home. We need to take care of our people. All of this great genius military planning and counterattacking and everything, honestly, it can wait. It doesn't make us weak. It makes us stronger. I want to ask you to do something before we wrap. I want you to help me, because I'm sure I'm not alone in this. Understand, I'm watching Channel 12 last night and going out of my mind, watching these pictures on Israeli TV and hearing all the experts talk. And of course, they're sort of trying to tell us the truth, but also trying to be reassuring. I'm not a weapons expert. So first we have, there were the two waves of drones, right? And then we have ICBMs, right? Like sort of mid/long-range ballistic missiles. Can you just take a few minutes and break down the weaponry and what was coming at us, as far as we know?
Yeah, the Iranians have, over the years, developed an impressive array of missiles. And we shouldn't underestimate their capabilities. They do have an impressive military defense industry, and they've been able to create, from short-range artillery rockets to long-range, almost ICBMs that can, or ballistic missiles that can definitely, they've been able to place satellites up in space. And if you can place a satellite up in space, then you can also carry a nuclear warhead for ranges of probably 1,000 to 1,500, if not more, kilometers somewhere throughout the region. So they have impressive missile capability. They have solid fuel, liquid fuel. different types of propellants, different two-stage, one-stage. That's when the missile takes off and it drops. If you ever watch, you know, astronauts take off into space, right? So the big thing launches and then it starts to throw off parts of those fuel canisters. So it has those capabilities as well. What we had sent at us last night, we still don't know the exact make of everything, but they have a drone called the Shahad drone, which is a suicide drone. It's a one-way drone. These are drones that carry several dozens of kilograms of explosives that can basically, like a missile, ram into something, but they can be, they're a little more accurate because you can either punch in GPS or you can steer them and they can actually hit targets that you want to hit, but they're slower moving. So they are an easier target than a missile is to intercept. On the other hand, sometimes drones are difficult to intercept and to detect because they're small and they can fly very low and try to avoid radar. And there was actually images that were coming out of Iraq last night where you actually saw low-flying drones. Because remember, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, on their way here, you could actually see them with the naked eye flying because they fly low. So that's one thing. By the way, the Shahad drone is also something that the Iranians have supplied the Russians. And the Russians have tried to use in their war and offensive against Ukraine, not with great success. On top of that, they have cruise missiles. Those are missiles that fly horizontally, right? As opposed to a ballistic missile, which takes off vertically and then re-enters the atmosphere. These can fly at a low altitude. And then, of course, you have the longer range ballistic missiles. They have a number of different kinds that they have, the Kermisher, the Shahab. We haven't seen exactly what type it is yet. They've made different claims of different names of missiles. Doesn't really make much of a difference. But for all of that, Israel's missile defense architecture performed pretty impressively last night. Let's just remind our listeners that we have here in Israel the Iron Dome for the short-range rockets, the David Sling for the medium-range and for the cruise missiles, and the Arrow 2 and the Arrow 3 for the long-range ballistic missiles. And then, of course, there is our Air Force, F-15s, F-16s, F-35s, our fighter jets that were able to intercept some of the drones as well as the cruise missiles.
So with respect to drone interception, my understanding, I'm sure, is partially right and partially wrong, is that we have a limited capability to intercept the low-flying, slow-moving drones. Is that correct?
Again, it's not that you have a limited capability. They're harder to detect because they're small objects. They fly very low. But on the other hand, because they fly slowly, if you can detect them, you can more easily intercept them.
Let me rephrase that. We have yet to develop a defense capability that can detect and intercept the low-flying, slow-moving drones effectively, correct?
Our capability, because as we've seen, drones have infiltrated Israel over the last few years and a number of times, it's more complicated. We have some capability, but it's a little more limited than, let's say, detecting a rocket that's fired at you.
And it was, I think, in February of this year that the government threw $300-$500 million at, I believe it was Elbit, to develop some kind of capability on an emergency basis to more effectively intercept these low-flying, slow-moving drones. I got that right?
Yes.
Okay. So that kind of supports my thesis, or what I'm saying is that we're limited and that's a hole. Back to sort of like shifts in paradigm thinking, we fell into these patterns of doing certain things really well and ignoring certain, you know, we needed to change some of our capabilities and abilities in the ways in which we assess militarily, including the ways when we do our military assessments, considering the impact on civilian populations. We both know that 20, 30 years ago, protection of the civilian population was at the top of the issue matrix for the Israeli military and government, civilian government. We both know that it's now number three or number four. And number one is protection of military infrastructure and civilian infrastructure. And then, because I remember seeing this a while ago, and I can't remember what the third one is. Civilians are way down the list. I don't even have a shelter. I live in central Tel Aviv. I don't have a proper shelter to go to.
It's a little more complicated than that.
Good. Tell me.
It depends on the nature of the threat, right? From Gaza, we've seen over the years that when they fire rockets, we have an adequate defense, right? And Iron Dome has provided I want to say hermetic because there's no such thing, but a very good umbrella over Israeli civilian population centers. And very few people are injured or killed because of rockets that are fired from Gaza. Now, that has to do with the fact of their limited capability, their limited number, and how far they're able to go. Hezbollah is going to be a different threat. They have more, and they can cause more damage. And therefore, if you have to prioritize what you're going to defend, you are right, Vivian, that you first will need to defend your Air Force bases, your critical infrastructure, because you need to ensure what we call in the Army operational continuity, the ability to continue to operate. That has to come first. Now, we, the civilians, will drop down a notch, which means there will be less Iron Dome, David Sling, et cetera, to defend us. Aero is nationwide. So that is something that, you know, will always defend everyone. But there will be less for the more limited attacks and or focused attacks on civilian population centers. And that's where what we call passive defense comes into play. So there's active defense, which is missile defense, and there's passive defense, which is the bomb shelter that you need to have near your home. And you need to go find out where that is. I have one in my building, thank God. That's where we went to 2:30, whenever it was. It's all vague. But you have to rely also on a combination, because the active missile defense is not always going to be available, and it's not always going to work.
Okay, so I'm a simple girl, Yaakov. And here's how I look at it from central Tel Aviv in my fabulous building. We've all figured out, it's a small building, we've all figured out the most secure place in the stairwell, okay? So everybody from the 8 or 9 apartments, including infants, that's where we huddle when we have attacks. We could be right, we could be wrong. The closest public shelter is way too far. It's just way too far, plus it was locked. And I can't imagine what it's like inside there. And I live right by Robin Square, okay? So no public shelter within a reasonable distance for all the people in this area, very central part of Tel Aviv, to go and shelter. And then you talk about the importance of securing, and I understand that. I think everybody understands that, securing military infrastructure, civilian infrastructure. So making sure that we continue to have a continued capability to generate electricity and produce desalinated water, right? All that kind of stuff is important for civilians. But also really important for civilians is to have confidence in those making leadership decisions. And if we look at the top priorities being perimeter security and military capability, and we look at October 6th, 7th, it's complete and abject failure. And I don't think that the public is brimming with confidence today in our leadership and military's ability to secure our perimeter. And now we have perimeter breaches from Iran. And so you're telling me it's more complicated than that. And I'm telling you, actually, it's not. You have 9.5 million people traumatized and sitting and completely ignored. No one's explaining anything to us.
Well, this goes back to what we spoke about before. We need leadership that can restore our confidence. And I think what we've learned, Vivian, is that this isn't over and it's not going to end soon. And there are going to be more challenges and hurdles along the way. And that's why it's so important that we have that type of leadership that we have faith in, that we feel is looking out for us. And maybe there are people who do believe in this leadership. I'm sure there are. Maybe you and I don't, but there's a lot of people who don't. And I think that needs to be, and you said this before, we have to take care of our house first. And I think you're 100% right. We're a country that still is in deep pain. And there's no easy fix here, except to do the hard work.
I want to wrap up, but first I want to make a point that I thought was quite interesting that I heard on a podcast as I was driving home from the South yesterday afternoon, that the Yom Kippur War, which, you know, is often referred to at a time like this, when there was also what was believed to have been a failure of leadership to imagine and to act appropriately, within 6 months of the conclusion of that very impactful, and that changed Israel, that war, and changed many things. Within 6 months of that war having ended, the country held elections, reelected a government, held an inquiry, the Granat inquiry, and Golda resigned within 6 months of that war having happened. We're sitting here in my view, kind of like in this kind of stasis. We're not moving. We're not doing anything. Our leadership, God knows what they're doing, but they don't even speak to us in a moment of what it might have been the most extreme crisis since 1948 for this country. They just disappeared themselves. I just wanted to make that point because I thought that was very profound, you know, and we are sitting here and many people, we know that the vast majority of people do not have confidence in Prime Minister Netanyahu, that they do want elections and everyone's, how do we do it? Leave that. What I want you to focus on in your final comments, observations is I'm going to tap Yaakov the prophet. What do you think's going to happen?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm at a loss.
Touch it. You're not even going to touch that one.
No, because I know what should happen. I know what probably won't happen. Maybe it will happen. I don't know.
Okay. What should happen?
We need to fight back. I think so. In principle.
Okay. So in principle, Yaakov Katz believes that we need to fight back.
Yes.
Militarily.
Yes.
Demonstrably from a place of power, proactive, and make a statement, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So go bomb Tehran or something like that. Or the nuclear. Okay. Yeah. That's what Yaakov thinks should happen.
But I'm skeptical that it will.
Okay. Okay. Yaakov, it's going to be quite a week.
It's understatement. Yeah.
I know. It's like for all you people out there, like we say it every week. And that's what I wonder is how much more intense can it get? I'm glad you're here with your family.
Just stay tuned because it'll get much more intense. Yes.
Really? All right.
Thank you, Vivian. Always a pleasure.
Always. And stay cool, dude.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the State of Tel Aviv.